From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
The bank bailout is over, but the fallout continues. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. TARP was introduced as a $700 billion bank bailout, but it only spent a bit over half that much, and it might end up costing just $29 billion. Cheap at the price if it staved off a depression, so why is it one of the most unpopular programs in history? TARP saved Wall Street, AIG, General Motors, and Chrysler, but it failed to keep homeowners out of foreclosure, and banks still are not lending. Do bankers getting bigger bonuses than ever think the government will bail them out next time? What are the prospects for that? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a perfect performance at just the right time. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. TARP, the bank bailout, has become the leading symbol for the current hatred of government on the left as well as the right. Was it the savior of the economy or the original sin? Now that it's over, what did it really cost? On Reporter's Notebook, Roy Halladay throws the second no-hitter in more than 1,000 postseason baseball games played since 1903. First, this news update. Since health care reform requirements went into effect, there's been stiff resistance from some businesses and insurance companies. Now it turns out the Obama administration has been granting waivers that will keep 1 million workers insured while denying them some consumer protections. Drew Armstrong writes for Bloomberg Business News. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Explain the trade-off here.
So how this works is that there are a number of kind of low-wage, maybe part-time seasonal workers around the country. These are people who work at, you know, fast food restaurants. They might be working in agriculture as pickers or growers. And their jobs have decided to offer them some form of health care insurance. And it's usually a plan that 'll offer them, say, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 worth of coverage. So if you break a leg, it's great for something like that. But if you get cancer and need treatment that might cost $1 million, you're responsible for all of that after that limit. Now, the law would have raised that limit to $750,000 before eliminating it entirely. So you couldn't have these plans anymore, which are called mini-med plans or limited benefit plans. But that would have made them so expensive that all these companies and these farm workers and things like that would have basically had to, you know, been thrown off their insurance, because you can't afford to, you know, spend $4,000 on insurance if you're a McDonald's employee making $12,000 a year.
So McDonald's, Jack in the Box, and others have said that they would drop out altogether or stop covering their people altogether if they had to do this. Some of the insurers indicated they were going to not provide coverage either.
Well, you see, there were about 1 million of these waivers in total given, waivers given for about 1 million people. And some of the big insurers, Cigna, Aetna, represent companies that provide these mini-med or limited benefit plans, as they're known. So they're really acting on behalf of those company clients or on behalf of what might be, say, you know, a labor union or something like that that provides these plans. They're asking for the waivers for the companies that they're providing this insurance for.
What about the politics of it? President Obama promised that nobody would lose their insurance when health care reform went into effect. Are these waivers in part an effort to maintain that?
Well, I think that's a great point, Warren. What you're seeing here is that promise exactly in play. You know, the president said, if you like your insurance, you can keep the insurance you have if you like it. And had these waivers gone into effect on these mini-med and limited benefit plans, these people would have lost their insurance in all likelihood, or it would have become so expensive that they couldn't afford it. So this is a way for the administration to kind of bridge its way and issue some waivers so as not to disrupt these insurance markets as we move towards 2014, when there's a lot of new options for people to be able to buy coverage using tax credits on these new government exchanges that are going to go open up.
Of course, the kinds of workers that you described may not like the policies, but like it or not, that's all they're going to get.
That's right.
So what will the impact of this be, do you think? Have the companies said that in exchange for the waivers, they will continue to provide the coverages that they already have?
Yeah, I mean, that is the early report that we are hearing so far. I mean, these companies want to be able to provide coverage. They know that they just can't afford to provide the kind of coverage that would be required under the new rules. I mean, they like being able to give their workers benefits. It's a competitive advantage in being able to hire people. I talked to a union of painters that's based out in this Maryland and D.C. area, and they said, you know, this is what we can afford to do right now. You know, we don't want to take a huge bite out of people's paychecks, but we want to be able to give them some security. You know, this some coverage, their argument is better than none. And I think that you will hear that from a lot of people.
But will the granting of waivers set a precedent that will lead other companies that maybe could afford it but would rather not to ask to be opted out too?
I think that's going to be something we're really going to need to watch, and that's probably going to be the next step of this story. You know, how far is the administration and how far our company is going to try to go when it comes to exempting people from parts of the health law? And I think that as more regulations come out, as more of this health law unfolds, we're going to see, you know, whether or not and how flexible the administration is willing to be on parts of it. This is really a Washington process that's going on right now with these waivers and companies, you know, having their lobbyists and writing in and saying, you know, we need to get an exemption from this, or else we're going to be forced to change what we do to the point where we can't do it anymore. And I think we're going to see a lot of that develop, and it's something that we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on.
A lot of pressure on the administration, too, just less than a month before the election.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the analysts that I spoke to made the very good point that, you know, having a million people around the country potentially forced to change their insurance plans a month before the election, or at least a really substantial altering in their insurance plans coming up a month before the election, is just not great politics. I mean, this was, in this analyst's point, a must-do in terms of how they had to handle this with the midterm elections so close.
Okay, nobody ever said there weren't politics involved in health care reform. Drew Armstrong, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Hey, thank you, Warren.
Healthcare reporter for Bloomberg News. In a moment, the bank bailout is over, TARP is over, but the fallout continues on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Nolley back with To the Point. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, officially ended last Sunday. It was rolled out 2 years ago in the midst of a worldwide financial panic by George Bush's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. He said he needed $700 billion to bail out the banks, and Congress gave it to him. Now, senators and representatives who are of both parties and the Obama administration are paying an enormous political price. Deborah Solomon has reported the story for The Wall Street Journal for a long time now. Deborah Solomon, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the price, the $700 million price. Is TARP going to cost anything near that?
$700 billion is probably the worst thing that probably ever happened to TARP, because they never actually even spent $700 billion. They spent at the peak, the money that's been gone out the door is $386 billion, although $460 billion has been quote unquote committed to certain projects. Some of that's not going to be spent, but all the money that's been spent has been the total is $386 billion, and so far about $200 billion of that has been repaid.
So not only has that been repaid, but more is expected to be repaid, is it not? As I understand it, it may end up costing in the neighborhood of between $29 and $50 billion.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's really unclear exactly how much we're going to wind up ultimately losing on this program, if anything. There are some in the administration who say that we may ultimately make a profit. I think it'll take years to know the ultimate accounting. But right now, their loss estimates are between $29 and $50 billion. And the reason it differs is because it depends on what the value of the investments that we still hold do. So we own shares in AIG. We own shares. We will own shares in this new General Motors once it has its initial public offering. And so it depends on, you know, how those things do in the market. If the market takes off and the stock price goes up, the U.S. could make a hefty profit.
So what was that $386 billion actually paid for? What did it go for?
A bunch of things. I mean, primarily it went into banks. The government started this program where they bought preferred shares in It's more than 600 banks across the country. Some of the largest, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, were sort of quote unquote forced to take the money. But smaller banks too. And actually a lot of those smaller banks still are holding onto that capital, about $65 billion worth. The rest of it went to the autos. You know, we had Chrysler Financial, GM, and then we had some special investments in Citigroup. We had AIG, and then some housing programs.
There were more goals, though, than just helping out those big companies.
Well, I mean, the goal here was to stabilize the financial system at the moment when it seemed like it was headed for, you know, as Ben Bernanke put it, Armageddon. Ultimately, you know, there will be a lot of debate about whether their programs worked. But when you look at the financial market now, it obviously is a lot more stable than it was in October, 2008. At the same time, the economy is not doing well. So there is a question about, you know, how successful this really was. Did it just get, you know, banks back to profitability while sacrificing taxpayer dollars?
Politically, if we're going to talk about this a bit later, but politically, as I think you meant when you said that $7 billion was the worst thing they could have done, this has caused an enormous amount of damage.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and it's actually interesting because it was started under a Republican administration and carried over by a Democratic administration, voted for by members of both parties, although there were a lot of Republicans who did not vote for it, and some who did are now having to wrestle with the fact that they voted for TARP and being asked about it on the campaign trail. So we're seeing some political costs. You know, you're seeing some incumbents like Mr. Bennett, Senator Bennett in Utah, was trounced in part because of his vote on TARP. I mean, at one of the rallies, people were yelling TARP, 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 and he basically lost his seat in part because he voted for the bailout. But you're also seeing, obviously, you have now this new regime. It's called the Dodd-Frank bill, which sort of rejiggers the landscape for financial regulation, including no more bailouts is the way they put it. There are some people who think what it actually does is institutionalize bailouts, and there are others who say, no, it makes it clear that taxpayers will never fund another bailout. The only thing that people, I think, agree on is that it really does guarantee there will never be another TARP because it was such a political minefield. I don't think anybody would ever want to stumble into that again.
And yet, if it did, in fact, to keep the economy from going into a depression, it certainly did a lot of good. But it's pretty hard to make the argument, I guess, that things could have been worse.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. You know, the counterfactual is hard to prove. And I think Barney Frank has said, you know, nobody ever got elected by saying it would have been worse. You know, it'll be worse if you vote for the other, would have been worse if you vote for the other guy. I mean, there is no way to prove how bad things would have been. But you have, you know, Republican and Democrats economists saying that it would have been markedly worse. We could have seen 20% unemployment. We could have seen a huge depression rather than just a long and painful recession. So I think most people would agree that it helped. It's just a question of how much.
Were there other bailouts in addition to TARP?
Well, I mean, there was Fannie and Freddie, the two mortgage giants, which got unlimited lines of credit from the government and basically are still being operated as arms of the government, and nobody's quite clear when or if they will ever be let go. That hasn't been resolved. It was not resolved in this financial regulation reform that Congress passed. The Obama administration is now working on a plan to figure out what to do with Fannie and Freddie, but people expect that the money that taxpayers put in will essentially have been lost.
Okay. TARP, though, was certainly the most expensive of the bailouts, even if it didn't get close to $700 billion, and it's the one most people are familiar with.
Well, actually, it's not. I mean, TARP, when you look at it, it's actually a much smaller piece of the overall financial bailout than what the Fed did. I mean, they opened up the spigot. They provided financing, you know, all sorts of financing for banks, for financial institutions. You know, they bought up treasuries. They bought up mortgage securities. They expanded their balance sheet by, you know, a couple of $1 trillion. So they actually did much more than this $386 billion program that has wound up taking all the heat.
Okay. We're going to talk more about the heat and about the program itself. Deborah Solomon, good to have you back on our program. Staff writer for the Wall Street Journal. Damon Silvers is deputy chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Thank you very much for being on our program.
A pleasure to be with you.
What are some of the things that the Troubled Asset Relief Program was designed to do but failed to do?
Well, I think much of what Deborah says kind of tells the story. When the bill was passed, the purpose was to try to address an unraveling financial situation, a true panic, and in doing so, to both help Main Street, to help the real economy, to help the housing markets, to help people facing foreclosure, and to help businesses that need credit from the financial system. The TARP was effective, our panel has found, at halting the immediate panic. And the way it did it was effectively by issuing an implicit guarantee for essentially all large financial institutions, a guarantee backed by the federal government. What it has not been effective at doing is those much broader and frankly more important things, which were to stabilize the housing situation, to address the foreclosure crisis, and to ensure that credit flowed smoothly to business, particularly to small business. The consequences of that, of those failures, particularly when paired with the success of the implicit guarantee for the large banks, have been very costly politically.
Is there still an implicit guarantee for those banks that if, in fact, they are to they engage in excessive practices and risks, that they'll be bailed out by the federal government?
Well, the thing about an implicit guarantee is that it's a little hard to prove whether it's there or not. But the credit rating agencies who rate the large banks, who rate Citigroup and Chase and B of A and the like, give a five-notch bump for the implicit guarantee.
Okay. Why did the TARP bailout fail to accomplish what you say were its most important goals, dealing with the housing crisis, foreclosure, try to prevent foreclosures, and easing up credit for smaller banks? And could it have done that if it were designed in a different way?
Well, I think that the answer is yes. It could have done it certainly much more effectively had certain decisions been made differently. Our panel as a whole, and on a bipartisan basis, has expressed the view first that TARP would have been much more credible and popular had it been more transparent throughout and had it been more essentially fair as between different TARP recipients. And I'll take an example of this. Deborah mentioned how many small banks have gotten money under TARP. Small banks had to pass a health test to get TARP money. It was the only criteria for getting that money. They had to show their regulators that they were indeed healthy or they wouldn't be given TARP money. It's quite clear that that test was not applied to large banks. In fact, large banks got more TARP money the less healthy they were, Citigroup, Bank of America, and AIG being the key kind of exemplars of that proposition. Now, that goes to sort of the politics of TARP and the legitimacy issues of TARP. More fundamentally, when our panel looked at after the basic bailout had been done and after the banks had been stress tested, and we looked at the question of what happened to all those toxic assets. Remember, TARP stands for toxic asset.
Troubled asset relief.
Right, a troubled asset relief program. So where are the troubled assets and what are they worth now on bank balance sheets? We looked at that question in August of 2009 and found that we couldn't answer it, that there was insufficient information available from the banks and from the TARP program to figure out the answer to that question. What that tells you is that we really have not dealt with the asset side of the balance sheet of the large banks. And the asset side is where all the troubled assets are. And as a result of doing that, our banks are, in my opinion, not strong enough to do their job of taking risk in the real economy. And that's why you see things like $1.2 trillion in bank assets parked at the Federal Reserve instead of being invested in the real economy. And that is the fundamental challenge. That's the fundamental issue. Where the kind of disconnect happened between rescuing Wall Street and rescuing Main Street.
Damon Silvers, again, Deputy Chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, worked for Elizabeth Warren until she got her new job very recently. Stay with us, if you will. I want to introduce Felix Salmon, a finance blogger for Reuters. Good to have you back on our show as well.
It's great to be here.
What about this question of whether, despite whatever effect, a good effect TARP might have had, we still are in a situation where banks can be too big to fail? I think we were beginning to hear that's exactly what the situation is, and so might be in a position to demand a bailout by the government again.
Well, yes, and this is inevitable in most big economies, honestly. Politicians love to talk about ending too big to fail, but what they mean by that is not that they're going to somehow create a world where banks are forced to be small and no bank or financial institution is going to be really big. No one even tried to do that. So you're always going to have really big banks and other financial institutions, which if they get into trouble, are going to need to be resolved in some way because they can't just be allowed to fail. But what the Dodd-Frank bill does and what some of the other things going on in Switzerland with capital adequacy standards do is they try and make it A, less likely that the big banks are going to fail, and B, they try and put the costs of failure and the resolution mechanism in place so that the banks wind up paying for that, and it's done in an orderly fashion rather than the sort of panicked bailout that we saw a couple of years ago.
So they do that through regulation?
Yes.
How strong are the regulations, and what are the prospects of any time soon of getting back into the same kind of situation that we were in 2 years ago?
The regulations are... Well, what we have is regulators, and they're just feeling their way into the new regulatory architecture that was set up by the Dodd-Frank bill. So right now, we don't really know who the regulators are going to be, how tough they're going to be, what they're going to force the biggest banks to do, how much extra capital they're going to force the biggest banks to have. There are a lot of unanswered questions. And ultimately, it's going to be up to humans, the human regulators, to make sure that these banks behave in a safe manner and that we don't end up in the kind of situation like we did and that we're not going to see that happen again. But if, you get a laissez-faire Republican president appointing people like Alan Greenspan to top positions who believe that the market should just be allowed to regulate itself, then yes, we can easily get back there again.
You said that it's inevitable that some banks are going to be too big to fail. A lot of people thought we should have gone back to the days of Glass-Steagall, enacted after the Great Depression in the 30s, repealed during the Clinton administration, which really would have put some limitations on how big banks could be and what they could do.
Well, Glass-Steagall didn't really have any size limitations. You still had very big banks. You just didn't have commercial banks and investment banks under the same roof. And remember that Lehman Brothers was perfectly fine under Glass-Steagall. It was a pure investment bank, as was Bear Stearns. And Lehman was clearly too big to fail because when it failed, all chaos was resulted. So it's and Fannie and Freddie as well were Glass-Steagall compliant. And in fact, AIG, for that matter, was Glass-Steagall compliant. So most of the big failures could have been in exactly the same place as they wound up in, even if Glass-Steagall had stayed on the book.
Okay. Felix Salmon, again, finance blogger for Reuters. We'll be back with him, Damon Silvers, and we'll also take with David Paul Kuhn at realclearpolitics.com about that aspect of things with the election just around the corner. On Reporter's Notebook, last night's no-hitter, a perfect performance at just the right time. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman, only back with To the Point. I want to talk more about the end of the TARP program this past Sunday. They can't lend money anymore. They're still, however, in a sort of cleanup phase, as we heard earlier. And I want to get back to Damon Silvers, the deputy chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Is this really inevitable? If the banks, and if so, if the banks know they're too big to fail and that they can get the government to bail them out, will they then be willing to take excessive risks when costs are low? Isn't this a perverse incentive, as it's called?
Yeah, well, I think the threat you mentioned is very real, and it comes back to the issue of regulatory reform and what will be done with it. Right? What will the regulators do with the powers they have? Our panel was required to make a regulatory reform report to Congress, and in that report, we urged that the regulators consider scaled capital requirements, where as banks get bigger, they would have to set aside more capital, which both mitigates against the idea of risk-taking by large banks and also levels the playing field with smaller institutions whose cost of capital is going to be higher because they're not government-guaranteed implicitly. The Dodd-Frank bill, to its credit, gives the authority to do that to the regulators, but it doesn't require they do that. And so that will, you know, whether regulators consider measures of that sort really will be the answer to the question of, are we going to repeat the dynamics that got us into 2008, or are we not?
So, Felix Salmons, back to you with Reuters. You said that what will matter is who the regulators are and what they decide to do. What about Wall Street and the culture of Wall Street? Is there any more caution there? Are there different incentives now for the traders that made so much money?
No, the incentive problems are still very much there. All of the ways in which the bonus culture, the way that people get paid millions of dollars for taking risks with essentially taxpayers' money, because it's the taxpayers who have that implicit guarantee for the really big. Those problems still exist, and there hasn't been any real attempt in the U.S. to clean up the incentive structure around executive pay and the pay of traders. So that's a big problem. I do think that I agree completely with Mr. Silvers that the key question of whether the biggest banks are going to be required to put up extra capital is crucially important. It has to happen. To its credit, Treasury has said that it is going to happen and they want it to happen, but we haven't seen any numbers yet.
Back to executive pay and bonuses. Have they gone down at all or have they gone up?
They went down. Their bonuses were lower back when the banks were losing money, and now the banks are making money again, and bonuses are back up again. In a lot of cases, the bonuses are just as high on a per-employee basis as they were before the crisis, and it's only because they have fewer employees that the total bonus pools aren't higher. So, yeah, I don't see a lot of progress on that front at all.
Well, let's get back to the politics of this then. When people look at the fact that their money bailed out the big banks, but that didn't help them avoid foreclosure and the other ravages that they have had to endure, the fact that small businesses can't get loans and so on. And now we hear that the pay and bonuses may be going up. But David Paul Kuhn is chief political correspondent for RealClearPolitics.com. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of reaction there has been politically and what we might expect not between now and November, but on the second day of November.
One, we really saw it in the days of TARP. Immediately, we saw that there was a public that was against TARP, that was against, in their minds, bailing out the big banks. And that has largely not changed since. It's only become a more, a larger wedge issue, a greater albatross for those who voted for TARP. And this is, of course, especially true for Republicans who voted for TARP. And as one of your earlier guests alluded to, the microcosm of that was Utah's Bob Bennett, who lost his seat as an incumbent senator in May, despite being one of the most conservative senators by most other measures. And really, we're now going to see, come November 2nd, how many other incumbents who supported TARP. There are seven Republicans up for re-election who supported TARP particularly. We'll see how many of them ultimately pay for that vote. But there is no vote that hangs around the necks of incumbents like TARP. Now, this is true for Republicans. This is true in purple districts where Democrats are on the line as well. And it may have, in fact, I think all evidence is that it was the right policy, but it was the wrong politics from the outset, and the public is vehemently against it.
One thing about Bob Bennett I think people need to know is that in Utah, he didn't face a Republican primary. That was a convention where, as we heard earlier from Deborah Salomon, people were yelling TARP, TARP, TARP at him. He was thrown out by the convention, which might indeed be, as sometimes is the case, the most I don't want to say extreme necessarily, but the people furthest to one side, to that side of the aisle that their party's on, he was thrown out by them, not by the voters. So have we had a test so far of a voter sentiment on this, or are we waiting for November?
I think we're waiting for November. You're right to note that. To be sure, those who vote in – we see this in presidential caucuses. Those who vote in these sort of insular contests that are not primaries are the greatest activists, and they tend to be the most ideologically pure, if you will. So they were true red Republican voters who pushed out Bob Bennett. Now, we will see what happens in November. There's interesting races. There's Lisa Murkowski, a writing candidate in Alaska, who supported TARP. What we can say is that clearly the advertising against those who supported TARP is hanging the vote on them, and candidates are either forced to defend it or rather they would not like to talk about it. And so there's really no question that it's an albatross for incumbents who support TARP, especially Republicans and Democrats in red or purple districts, in districts that really lean, you know, could traditionally lean Republican, but Democrats won in recent cycles. But we'll see in the end whether it's a deciding factor. Nonetheless, it's clear to say that it was the spark of both, if you had to pick a spark, it was the spark of both the Tea Party movement and of what became the anti-big government fervor that we've seen in the Obama era. And to be sure, it really brought back what has been a centuries, if not decades-long tension with government that has really defined the American mind since there has been an American mind.
So it's a bigger deal than healthcare reform.
Absolutely. Well, healthcare reform, the politics of healthcare reform must be thought of as an outgrowth of what happened with TARP. In other words, ultimately, healthcare reform came down to debates over big government, which have really defined our politics, especially since the Great Society era, but of course far before that, long before that, certainly in FDR's day and before. And so if the debate over healthcare ultimately was rooted in this debate over the role of government in people's lives, the initial debate in the contemporary, you know, the beginning of that debate was TARP.
Isn't it true, though, that even on the left, populists are angry about TARP, too, because it appears to have helped out the banks and Wall Street and not the little guy with his mortgage?
That's right. I think that they're angrier. The left is angrier about financial reform and perhaps it being not as strong as they would have liked, certainly not being as strong as they would have liked. You do see a difference between Republicans and Democrats on TARP, and it's important to note that, and it really that gets back to the ideological platform of both parties and the role of government. But yes, certainly the left has issues with TARP. Americans did not like TARP, just some Americans, let's say 40% roughly, thought it was necessary. But the very idea of Main Street bailing out Wall Street, which is effectively what occurred, of course, sat well with nobody, and it's just that a minority of America and a majority of experts believe that bullet had to be bitten.
David Paul Kuhn, again, Chief Political Correspondent for RealClearPolitics.com. Let me go back to Damon Silvers with the Congressional Oversight Panel. If there's this kind of a political situation, and the government and the situation might occur again where the government is being called out to bail out the banks, are they going to be able to do it? Or is the government going to be able to do it?
I think that the government would find redoing TARP in the way that I described TARP in both the positive and negative forms to be extremely difficult. And although I believe that TARP did halt a panic, I think that this style of bailout is not a good idea to repeat, meaning that we have seen banking crises in the United States before. Your guest from Real Clear Politics talked about the American political mind. There was a massive bank restructuring during the Great Depression by both the Hoover administration and the Roosevelt administration. There was a massive restructuring of the S&L industry in the late 80s and early 90s. Neither effort produced the negative political reaction that TARP produced. In fact, both were fairly popular, particularly the restructuring of the banks and the Depression. The reason why and the reason for the difference, in my opinion, was that there was massive accountability for the banking sector during both those episodes, and the balance sheets got cleared and the banking system began to function again for Main Street. And the absence of those features in TARP, not the fact that action was taken to stop a panic, but the absence of the features that made it seem fair, right, that made it seem to be what Americans have always wanted their government to do, which is to counterbalance private power. The absence of those features in TARP has been the ruin of TARP as a political initiative.
David Paul Kuhn, you buy that?
I would add to that two things. One is you have to consider the history after the Second World War. In other words, what's happening in the 1890s or in the FDR era, it's really the very beginning of the progressive era. It's the very beginning of a federal government that is there not just to prevent bad but promote good. By the Great Society, the concept starts to take hold, especially in the middle class, especially the white working and middle class, that of the excesses of big government. And the Great Society loses majority support by about 1966, within 2 years of its peak, if you will. And so that history, that tension with big government that, of course, defined the Reagan era, really was fertile soil that kind of was forgotten about, I believe, in 2009, at the end of 2008. And we've only been returned to the gravity that has long defined American politics. And I would add to that also that this is to take nothing from the accountability point, but you also have to think about the absence of what did not happen besides TARP. This is a blue-collar recession. Roughly 3 in 4 jobs lost are blue-collar. These people do not feel helped by government. So what they see is a government that only costs them and offers little to help them. And ultimately, that has been the failure of the Democratic Party since the Johnson era. And Barack Obama has returned himself, even though this is rooted in George W. Bush. It's ultimately because it plays to stereotypes of liberalism and of a Democratic president that it really weighs down the Democratic Party. And certainly it weighs down Republicans who, in that moment, took what I would say was a politically brave vote, but one to which they are paying for.
So if accountability wouldn't do the job, then the question becomes, David Paul Kuhn, you're saying, the next question would be, what could the government do if we got into a situation like that, if we didn't have the political will to bail out even with that? Let me go back to Damon Silver's.
I don't want to say accountability wouldn't do the job. I just want to say that it would not mend the great tension and the great anger towards TARP. That anger would exist without improvements in accountability, in my mind.
Felix Salmon, back to you, our finance blogger for Reuters. Let's go back to Wall Street and the behavior of people on Wall Street who seem not to have changed their behavior very much. Don't they see the consequences of their actions, or do they feel they're just insulated from them?
From their point of view, the ones who are still on Wall Street, who haven't lost their jobs, the consequences of their actions have been almost unnoticeable. They had to go a year with a much lower or no bonus, and now they're back to where they were. Even up to the very top of the heap, the people like Dick Fuld, who are running Lehman Brothers, who did lose their jobs, still are living in great comfort with hundreds of millions of dollars to their name. It's the small, you know, homeowners in foreclosure and the small business owners who can't borrow money. You know, it's Main Street which is bearing all of the cost here, and of course taxpayers generally who paid for a lot of the bailout, and savers as well who now can't get any interest on their funds because the Fed has to have a 0% interest rate. So it's it's you and me, it's the small people, the non-Wall Street titans who are paying for all of this crisis, and, you know, especially more than anyone else, the unemployed. The Wall Streeters who created the crisis are back to where they were, they're sitting pretty, and they're making bonuses, and the crisis really has not affected them.
So, David Paul Kuhn, we're in a situation where people don't like big government. They don't like the private sector either, at least not as represented as just now.
That's right. I mean, and we know this from polling. It's empirically true that not only has the reputation of big government gone to the toilet, but so has the view of big finance and big business more generally. So institutions themselves have become less popular in recent decades, but few institutions are as unpopular as the federal government and big finance. And I think that your last guest just put it very well. I think in the end, Americans has in their minds, most Americans have seen very little in the form of life rafts from their government that feel very tangible and that have impacted their lives in what has nearly been the last 2 years. And yet they feel TARP or the potential cost in the years to come of health care or these other policies in their minds reminds them of the cost of big government. And to be sure, when they see Wall Street reporting record bonuses, it is a it is really salt on the psychic wounds of Americans who feel that they rightly did bail out the fat cats, to use that term, and got little, not only in the form of gratitude and in the form of propriety from Wall Street, but certainly in the form of policy from Washington.
So we'll see what happens in November, but conceivably we are at a real crisis point in the United States right now.
I just would say that this does not mean that the government will not act if there's another crisis like this. I would say that if you can pull, you could also take away a positive theme, as I like to point out, from that TARP vote, as I also think was true in Germany and Merkel's government when they ultimately supported bailing out Greece. I would say that when put to the fire, there was some political bravery from some politicians that we often deride as being cowardly and, you know, caving to polls constantly. And I think that you can say that even if it's all exceedingly unpopular, I just don't see, maybe I'm a bit of an optimist, I don't see the governing body as being so weak as to ever let, in the modern day, the financial sector ultimately just fall off the precipice.
Okay, so we're left then with the hope that the elected officials will do the right thing at the right time,
regardless of the political outcome.
David Paul Kuhn, again, chief political correspondent for RealClearPolitics.com. Many thanks to you. Thanks to Felix Salmon, finance blogger for Reuters, and Damon Silvers, deputy chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which ended on Sunday, and for thanks to our earlier guest, Deborah Solomon, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. In more than 1,000 postseason games played since the World Series began in 1903, only once had there been a no-hitter. Here's what happened last night in Philadelphia.
Just about a quarter to eight, October the 6th, 2010, the first postseason game for Roy Halladay. He winds the 0-2, swing and a dribbler out in front of the plate. Ruiz out to get it. The throw from his knees, it's in time, and it's a no-hitter. Unbelievable. Ruiz and Halladay embrace, and the Phillies again celebrate around Roy Halladay.
Back in a moment on To The Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Roy Halladay was the pitcher who threw yesterday's second postseason no-hitter, the second in what's it been since 1903. He was playing for Philadelphia in the first game of their division playoff against Cincinnati. Matt Money Smith is co-host of the Pitros and Money Show on KLAC AM 570 in Los Angeles, also heard nationally on Fox Sports Radio. Good to have you on our program. How about that?
Yeah, good to be here, Warren. Thank you. It is remarkable. Just the second in, I believe you said, the first in over 1,200 postseason games. Of course, everybody's heard about the perfect game pitched by Don Larsen in the 1956 World Series when the Yankees defeated the Brooklyn Dodgers. And to have Roy Halladay do it in his first career postseason start really was something special, because he has been the best pitcher in baseball for the last half decade. And given that opportunity, it's pretty special to see someone finally earn his way onto that stage and then deliver when given that opportunity.
This is his second no-hitter this year.
Had a perfect game on May 29th. So for people that don't know the difference, perfect game, no walks, no errors, no hits. He did have one walk in that game yesterday, which is why it was a no-hitter as opposed to a perfect game. But, you know, and then you go back to his start prior to this. His final start of the regular season was a two-hit complete game shutout against the Washington Nationals. He was on 8 days of rest before this game one start of the postseason. And you know, the difference in what happens when you have a pitcher like Roy Halladay is the lack of walks, no free passes for batters. So you're not looking over your shoulder to see if someone's interested in breaking, if a hit and run is on, if there's going to be a sacrifice to move someone over. And that's been the theme when Roy Halladay's been dominant, no walks to any of the batters that have faced him.
So Philadelphia can't pitch him every day. I'm sure they'd love to. But what would be the impact, or what do you think will be the impact on Cincinnati to lose like that in the first game of a postseason series?
Well, it's going to be tough because, you know, people have suggested that perhaps Roy Halladay, as great as he's pitching, has not pitched as well as of late as the one that the person that's going to start game two for the Phillies, and that's Roy Oswalt, another pitcher that came over in a midseason trade. He, in his postseason career, he is 3-0 with an ERA that is below one. That's an earned run average, the amount of runs you give up over the course of a nine-inning game. So he's giving up less than a run every nine innings when he pitches in the postseason. That is how good Oswalt has been, and it's hard to believe that someone could be better than someone that throws a perfect game and a no-hitter in the same season, but he's been that dominant.
You mentioned Halliday, you think, has been the best pitcher in baseball for a couple of years at least. Here's this very interesting article in Sports Illustrated about Don Larson, the man, the other guy that got a no-hitter in the postseason, in the World Series. And here's the way it's described, or he's described in Sports Illustrated. It says that this nobody junk baller came out of nowhere, not even knowing he was going to start that day, until he found a ball placed in his shoe by his manager, Casey Stengel. That's a great story. About as different from Halliday as you could be.
A whole lot. Really, safe to say, a highly anticipated start for Halliday. And I guess, you know, that begs the question, what's tougher to do if you don't have any expectation when you walk into that clubhouse and you find out you're pitching that day versus there's so much expectation on what I'm about to walk out there and do. The pressure is on, will I be able to deliver to what everybody expects me to do when I step on that bump and take that ball? And the thing for Halliday, you know, and there's so many of these stories in baseball and anecdotes and metaphors, but one of my favorite, because he's now being compared to Sandy Koufax, you know, who has been probably considered the most dominant pitcher, the toughest to hit pitcher in the history of baseball. Granted, he had a very short window that he did it. But, you know, one of the great lines about trying to hit, you know, a ball off Sandy Koufax was delivered by, I believe it was Willie McCovey, when he said trying to hit Sandy Koufax is like eating soup with a fork. And that's essentially what batters are describing with Halliday now in this season, his balls. And to try to draw the picture for people that don't really understand baseball, when you have a ball that's coming at you at 95 miles an hour, you have to kind of guess a little bit and try to figure out if it's curveball, is it going to break away from me, is it going to break in, is it a slider, will it break late, is it a cut fastball so it'll break at the very last moment, or is it a changeup that instead of coming in at 95 miles an hour, it comes in at 80, but it looks like it's a fastball. Roy Halliday has every single one of those pitches. Most great pitchers in baseball have command over two of them, and he has command over four to five of them. That's how good he is.
How long has he been playing? He's 33 years old. How long is he, if presuming no injuries and so on, how long do you think he might keep going?
Oh, he signed I believe it was a three-year extension. He's 33. He signed a three-year, $60 million extension this offseason. So the Phillies have him under contract until he's 36. And I think perhaps, you know, a phrase that's very familiar to even the casual baseball fan is Moneyball, which was a philosophy instituted by the general manager of the Oakland A's, Billy Beane. He doesn't like the idea of drafting high school players. He prefers a larger sample size when he brings amateurs into his organization. Roy Halliday was taken right out of high school. Now, granted, he was a special pitcher in high school. He really kind of popped up on scouts' radars when he was 13 years old. He was tutored by the legendary Bus Campbell out there, who also did Goose Gossage and Brad Lidge and a number of kids in the Colorado area. And in his second start for the Blue Jays, which I believe was in 1998, so he probably would have been between 20 and 21. He was one out away of throwing a no-hitter. He gave up a one-hitter, two outs in the ninth inning, and I believe he was throwing against the A's, and they got a little slap single off him. So they've known he's had the talent. He's been top five in Cy Young voting, which is the award given to the best pitcher in each league every year for the last half decade, winning one of those, and it really has been consensus. And I'll tell you, Warren, you know, in baseball, we know the hitters, so, you know, they are stars. The home run hitters, Ryan Howard, Alex Rodriguez, Derek Jeter, but there's just been a paucity of dominant pitchers probably the last 5 or 6 years since Pedro Martinez and Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling got a little bit older. So to have Halliday do this really is something special for the league.
We've just got about a minute left, but you described so vividly what it's like to stand there at the plate and face one of these guys, and when that ball comes screaming down at you at 95 miles an hour. What about Halliday, who apparently is a very calm guy, doesn't get nervous like some pitchers do?
No, you know, and a lot of times, you know, look, baseball's 162 games a season. You know, they get a day off every month, maybe. Most of these guys are not pleasant to deal with. He's a very benign superstar. He's very pleasant, very soft-spoken, almost workmanlike, you know, bring your lunch pail, punch the clock. I'm here to go to work. I don't care if I'm 33 and make $20 million a year. This is what's expected of me. This is what I'm going to do. The media expects me to talk after my start. That's what I'm going to do. Really is a breath of fresh air when it comes to superstars and those that can just rely on their accomplishments on the field and not have to be pleasant off it.
Okay, Roy Halladay, I think a lot of people are going to be watching the Phillies that might not have watched them before, even though they are pretty dominant, particularly with the kind of pitching that they've got. Matt Money-Smith, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Always enjoy it. Thanks for having me, Warren.
Co-host Petros and Money Show on KLAC and Fox Sports Radio. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again.
PRI, Public Radio International.